The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Welcome back. 25 minutes before 8. As I've been saying to you, it's a pretty packed program this morning. We started off with an insightful interview on the fire services and what's going on there. And now, as I said, the youth perspective post-budget analysis, full studio. We have with us this morning, at this point in time, four individuals, and we are expecting another one to join us in not too long. So there's a lot to talk about. Let's begin by allowing our guests to introduce themselves. And we start off with a young lady that I've spoken to her before. She's been in the studio, but let's get her to tell you a bit about herself for those of you who may have missed that. And that's former National Youth Parliamentarian Chrisette Benjamin. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Trinidad and Tobago, and good morning. It is a pleasure to join in studio again and to be part of this fruitful discussion. I am Chrisette Benjamin, 23 years of age, founder and president of the I Believe in Success Foundation, two-time former National Youth Parliamentarian, and a strong advocate for youth. That's it.
Let's move on. We have Kemuel. Tell me how you pronounce your name.
Sure. So good morning, Trinidad and Tobago. I am Kemuel Pascal.
Right.
I'm 23 years of age, former national, regional, and Commonwealth Youth Parliamentarian.
Nice to have you with us. And next to you, we have Chris Hussein, former... All of you on this National Youth Parliament thing. Okay, yeah. Tell us about yourself, Chris.
Yes. Good morning, Trinidad and Tobago. And good morning to the listening audience of Freedom 106.5. I am Chris Hussein. As you said, also a former national and regional youth parliamentarian. I have also served on the student guild at my university, and I've always had an appetite for student engagement and youth leadership.
Oh yeah, you need to speak a little closer to the microphone so the listeners can hear you. And we have this gentleman, I don't know if he was ever, were you? He's CEO of the Heroes Foundation. No, that's Lawrence Arjun. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. And actually, no, I was not a youth parliamentarian, but I really do respect the work that comes through the youth parliament because we get bright young people like the ones here today. So it's the truth. So my name is Lawrence Arjun. I'm the chief executive officer of the Heroes Foundation. We are a prevention-based development center for youth leadership and mentorship in Trinidad and Tobago.
I've had some discussions with representatives of the Heroes Foundation in the past. Definitely yeoman's service. A lot of their work goes under the radar, but there is a lot that happens, and we're expected to join us a little later on. Kobe Nathan Sandy, he's a youth leadership advocate as well. Before we get into our discussions, let me ask, because are you all politically aligned?
No.
No, I mean, listen, it's about being it's a frank discussion we're having, and if you are politically aligned, I'd like to know, so that when we have the discussions, I can understand where your perspective is coming from. Are you all politically aligned?
At this point in time, no.
Okay.
I'm not, no.
I think that is an interesting question. And I want to put it to you this way. I think in Trinidad and Tobago, we have this idea that if you are politically affiliated to any party, that your opinion is somewhat slanted with an agenda. And I think what is more important here is that there are young persons who participate in politics, in partisan politics.
Right.
Most of us here did. I know that Kobe is an alderman. I want to congratulate him on his appointment. I think that appointment signaled to Trinidad and Tobago that political parties are listening and they're interested in what we have to hear and what we have to say, and our contributions matter. But I don't think it's a matter of if we're politically affiliated or not that the opinion would be less than or more than anyone else's.
Well, so, I never said that.
I know you didn't say that, but I found the question to be an interesting one. So I just wanted to put that out there again as my youth perspective.
But you didn't answer the question.
Am I politically aligned? I do vote. I'm a participant.
That's not my question. My question is, are you politically aligned to any political entity? That's a yes or no question.
Well, I think I am at this moment.
Okay,
yes.
That's all. Simple. Mr. Arjun.
I am not.
Okay, great. Let's start off by getting three of you and Mr. Arjun. Three of you have been in the National Youth Parliament. That is quite an experience for young people who are as inclined as you all are when it comes to national issues. Because the parliament is where, many people might not agree with this, but that's the heart of the nation. That's where all the decisions are made. That is where all the mistakes are made as well. And it is the parliament that charts this country's future with the advice or the guidance or the suasion of the wider community. Because you would have activists who would, political, general, however, would influence what happens in the parliament. But at the end of the day, parliamentarians make the decisions. And they are the ones who, in my opinion, need to be held accountable. That's not taking place. Because the system does not allow for parliamentarians to be held accountable, other than local government, which is a referendum, and general elections, which comes every 5 years. So we have a system now where a party in power has a minister of finance that drafts a budget for the year. And that budget is presented, we are told, with the consultation of stakeholders, even though we don't have the information to say how much of the advice or the suggestions are included in what the national budget is. So let's start. All of you, well, three of you and the other one to join, are politically minded because of the Youth Parliament, and our other guest is civic minded because he's dealing with people and everything else. So let's start. Ladies first. What's your summary of this financial package presented by our Minister of Finance?
Okay, so thank you for the question. I want to start off by saying that firstly, analyzing the budget by just reviewing the minister's finance is a skewed way to look at this budget. You have to look at exactly what the funds are going into, and you get more information when you review the public sector and the social sector investment program. I actually took some time last night and today to really look at what it dives into, and it clearly explains exactly what the government intends to do. Now, my issue is that there will be all these plans, and it's aligned to the 2030 vision for the Trinidad and Tobago. But implementation seems to be the issue, because there are some brilliant plans when you review the sector investment programs. But time and time again, they have these plans, these plans. It is really implementation. And then I feel like communication is lacking in Trinidad and Tobago. So they have these plans, for example, to give 300 water tanks. They're going to be building 400 units for low-income households, etc. But you often find people who are most in need do not even access these things because they are not aware. So that is my overview. And I also find that there's a need to tap into sectors that has so much potential. I noticed that the minister would have said that it is the non-energy sector that contributed to the growth of Trinidad and Tobago. Yet still, you are not seeing enough initiatives being put in place to really boost the non-energy sector. So that's my point of view for this time.
And let's move on.
Sure. So I think when we look at the budget here in Trinidad and Tobago, when at least I look at the budget, I think it's viewed from a sector or a person or whatever entity that you represent. Most people look at their interests in it. And that's, we could be frank about that. If you are probably on the lower end of things, you probably look at what there is in the social sector, what is provided to the Ministry of Social Development and Family Services. If you are in the business community, you look at things like VAT refunds. So I think looking at the budget from a youth perspective, what I gather is that a lot of good has been done, but like Chris had mentioned, it's a matter of us delving deeper into the budget documents itself. The things like the review of the economy, the public sector investment program, the social sector investment program, and all the different documents. And I think that's where education comes in, and educating the people of Trinidad and Tobago about the budget is not just the statement, but it's actually something that you need to dive deeper into.
I'm also saying,
when I listened to the budget, there were some good things in there. There were some optimistic things in there, hopeful things in there. But then, and as Chris says, and Camuel rightly, they put it that you the devil is in the details. And so you have to go through the documents that that comes with the statement. So the reality of that optimism is something that I had to question, and those things would have, well, I zoned in on the energy sector. And I mean, we heard the thumping of the desk. We heard a number of congratulatory messages from the Minister of Finance, a patting on his back as it pertains to the negotiations, the certain oil and gas negotiations. And we're happy about that. But the fact is, and it remains, that certain things like the Dragon Gas deal, we have been speaking about that since the People's Partnership Government from 2013. That is an entire decade. Now we're just having a conversation, not to mention the technical challenges. There's no timeline properly. There are the cross-border taxation that we do not know about, the financing we don't know about. And then the waiver, that two-year waiver is very interesting. Former Minister Mariano Brown, he expanded on that and explained to us why that two-year waiver is very, it's not enough time to get this negotiation. I mean, we could go into the Manatee project. We were told that we were supposed to get gas. We were supposed to see gas in 2024. And now they're telling us, all right, well, maybe we're getting this in 2028. I think it's highly unacceptable at this point. And then even in that, Curtis Williams said that the certificates of the environmental clearance have not been given. So whilst we congratulate, and it's good to hear those things, and I must congratulate the government with regards to the three nomination blocks with the consortium with BP and Shell, but the fact remains the same. And anyone who understands the life cycle of a hydrocarbon, you could sign a deal tomorrow, but oil and gas is not something that will be a reality in terms of the next 5 to maybe even 8 years, because you have the exploration part, the drilling appraisal wells, you have all of those things to consider. Not to mention, you can't strike no oil. Then the surveying method is the first part with the exploration. Then you have to look at your profitability forecast. So it's not just let us thump the desk because of that. But again, optimistic. Do I think doom and gloom? No, I don't think doom and gloom.
Mr. Arjun, let's get your take on the budget.
Thanks a lot, Satish. What I want to do is really re-emphasize that the budget is a tool to help us allocate our available resources to meet the goals needed to achieve our vision. And I think it's really important that we don't just look at the budget as this annual activity, but we understand how it enables the vision that we want to have for Trinidad and Tobago. And Vision 2030 is one vision, yes, but I think everybody in Trinidad and Tobago has a vision for the country. So how does the budget align to the vision that we all have? I mean, at Heroes, we work with a bit over 500 young people from across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And Gen Zs in particular are concerned about the future that they are going to be inheriting. So from what they've shared with us, I would articulate three key points for their vision for Trinidad and Tobago. And one, that is economic well-being, where they can not only meet their basic survival needs, but also have sustainable incomes and assets so that, you know, they can prosper. The second one is equality, safety, and security. And a lot of that is directly linked to the economic well-being, but also includes a lot of other protection mechanisms in the state. And the third one is energy security, climate action, and environmental sustainability, because they want, young people really want a world to look forward to where we can, I mean, just building off of what Chris's point here, power the future. And I want to touch a little bit on power, because it's important. Chris spoke about Dragon and Manatee and whatnot. I mean, the good thing about our energy sector is that we work with big multinational players, the Shell, BP in here. The Manatee project is being done not only with Trinidad and Tobago nationals, but with Shell. So the forecast that they would have presented for 2028 gas will come from a lot of technical reviews. And Chris is right, it takes a lot of work to go into exploration and production. But the reality is we are in a mature hydrocarbon basin, and we have to find ways to get gas to power what we need, electricity being one of them. I was actually slightly disappointed that we didn't get some RIC feedback in the budget, because the electricity subsidy is a challenge that we have to look at really critically as a country going forward. When you fly over the Caribbean in the night, Trinidad and Tobago is lit up like a star on a Christmas tree. We are wasting a lot of electricity. Our electricity is generated from natural gas. It is the cleanest fossil fuel, but that natural gas could also be used for petrochemicals and to generate an income, because the majority of our income comes from what we can generate for exports. We can't tax the country and expect to be sustainable for the rest of our lives. We have to find ways of generating income externally and bringing it back to the country. The oil and gas sector allowed us to do that. As we go forward with the investments that are being made, how are we now ensuring that those investments are laying the foundation to diversify well and supplement that foreign income coming in that we have seen falling off from the energy sector?
You know, it's interesting, the figures presented by our Minister of Finance. And Kola Member has the benefit of being probably the first finance minister in a pretty long time to serve as Minister of Finance for an uninterrupted period of two consecutive terms. And it doesn't seem as though he's going to be moved, because in 2025 is general election. It would be foolhardy to move him as Minister of Finance. So we can expect that Kola Member is going to present 10 budgets to this nation. He has, through that mere fact, been responsible for this country's economic fortunes for a decade, which is a significant portion of time in any country's development. Now, we understand that the Minister of Finance works with a cabinet, he works with a government. He does not operate in a silo. And his budget is really the government's budget, is the government's financial plan. In 9 years, do you all think the quality of life for citizens has gotten better? Don't all answer the same point. Because at the end of the day, that is what a budget is about. About your citizens, about your country's economic well-being, and the political semantics we don't care about. Really and truly, politicians and political advocates go argue left, right, and center about what good and what ain't good and who do better and all of that kind of nonsense, which we're not here to discuss this morning. That's a very important question. Is the quality of life for citizens in this country better off 9 years after Kola Member?
Okay, I guess everyone is looking at me here to answer. There are a few factors that we have to consider when we're looking at the quality of life for people in Trinidad and Tobago. And there are a few factors, quite actually, because of the pandemic, quite a number of factors which were beyond our control that impacted upon that. And the reality is that a lot of people in the country are focused on survival at this point. Everybody is trying to ensure that we can survive because things have gotten a lot harder. That being said, I think the pandemic was an excellent opportunity for us to pivot as a country and to force some of the changes that we needed to see. So there are critical things that we need to be doing. And I think you are sparking a conversation here that we do need to have more of. What are we doing to ensure, coming back to the three points, that we can have economic well-being, equality, safety and security, and energy security, climate action, environmental sustainability going forward with decreasing resources coming into the country? The reality is we have decreasing resources coming into the country. The oil and gas sector is earning less money. We need to find ways to make more money.
But because... Because
less money means a lower quality of life.
But that requires greater leadership. Just because you have less money, you don't throw your hands up in the air and say, well, all right, we have less money, that's the end of the situation. It requires a greater insight. It requires thinking outside of the box. It requires solving that problem. Because that's your job. Mm-hmm. Your job is to treat with the challenges that the nation is confronted with. And I do not give Kola Member a get-out-of-jail-free card by saying, well, we're earning less money. What are we doing about it? What have we done in his 9 years to fix that? Because let's take it to a home situation, which I like to do so that the average individual can understand what we're talking about. If you're earning $10,000 a month, but over time, you're spending more, which is what we've been doing since 2009, we have been earning $10,000, but we're spending $12,000. And from 12, they're going to 13, and from 13, they're going to 14, and 15, and 16, to a point where for well over 12, 13 years, this country has been spending more money than we're earning. And nobody has sought to stem that, because all of them present deficit budgets. Even when the People's Partnership had more money than anybody else, we were earning more money, and we were still borrowing money. And I couldn't understand that. So we're focusing on Colin, but because of the 10-year period that he's going to be guiding us. So when we get back, the other three of you, I'll give all a little more time. Well, lucky he had a sporty moment, but you all have a little more time to contemplate that question. Is the quality of life for citizens in this country better after 10 years or moving on 10 years with the stewardship of Colin Mbembe? Some may say it's an unfair question. I don't think it is. I'll get your view when we get back.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5. This is the Morning Rumble with Satish Mahabir.
Four minutes after eight is the final hour of our show here this morning. And we do have several guests with us as we speak about the youth perspective. Looking at our budget and some of what our young people have to say about it, before we went to the break, I'd asked the question about quality of life and whether or not our citizens are experiencing a better quality of life. We had one response thus far from Mr. Arjun. Let's move on to Mr. Hussein. What's your opinion? Are citizens leading a better quality of life after Colin Mbembe and his ninth budget?
I think...
Can you just speak a little closer to the mic?
I think what Mr. Arjun put into context there with the pandemic is a fair point.
Mm-hmm.
But I recall the first question that you asked, if we were politically aligned and so on and so forth. And it is because of this government's performance that I decided in 2019 to become politically aligned, because I was not satisfied with how the country was being run. And I think in this budget, we saw a $5 billion allocation to social grants. And I don't think that is something any government should boast about. I mean, we're happy and we're grateful, because the fact is, the Trinidad and Tobago people, we really are in need of certain things. For example, the school grants, I think that's a very good. So the more we can help out our citizens, yes, but the social safety net is becoming so big. And I think it has to be a result of ineffective policy. I do think so. So I don't think that the quality of life... And you see, it's in the news. I mean, look now, with home invasions. That is, I mean, we haven't had a con... We did not have that type of conversation in 2017 or 18. And I'm quoting the So progressively, things have worsened. And it's unfortunate. And, well, I think one of the overarching things about this budget, it signaled to me that elections are due. I think that's what it signaled to me.
Mr. Pascal, what's your take?
Sure. So, right off the bat, on the quality of life, it has not improved here in Trinidad and Tobago over the last, let's say, from 2015 to now. But I also do think that, to be fair, we have to look at these things from different perspectives and different from a particular context. So we have to look at our fortunes, obviously. Where at present, we're an oil and gas-based economy, for the most part. And also we receive some stuff from, you know, the non-energy sector, being manufacturing and other different sectors. So let's be fair in terms of what we have to work with. But as you mentioned before the news, that's not an excuse or a get out of jail card for the Minister of Finance. It's that, yes, we have limited resources now, and we are not able to give the citizens as much as we would have probably been able to give between in previous years. But that is to say, that's where we need to pivot and ensure that our policies are in line to get us out of a deficit. Because as you mentioned, we've been having deficit budgets since 2009
mm-hmm.
coming forward. And so we have to ask ourselves, why have we been budgeting that way and not attempting to get ourselves out of that in order to ensure that our citizens do have a better life, a better quality of life?
Yes, Chriselle, what's your opinion?
To build on the points raised before, beyond COVID-19, we also need to take a look at what has been happening in the global community. For example, the Ukraine-Russia war, that would have boosted global inflation as well. So that would have indirectly and directly impacted the costs of living in Trinidad and Tobago. But also agreeing with you all, we really need to look at alternatives. And I would reiterate that the minister would have said that the non-energy sector would have been very fruitful and contributive to economic growth in Trinidad and Tobago. So there is a need to really place focus and emphasis on this. And my passion is really and truly social development. And I think that we really need to analyze and ask ourselves the question, are we fostering a culture of dependency? Because we are giving all these grants, but there needs to be an aspect that helps persons to not only get the fish, but teach themselves how to fish. So that is something we need to rethink if we really want to boost the social welfare in Trinidad and Tobago.
If I may, the minister did, I heard it early, the early half of the budget about the non-energy sector and how they did so well, and he was posting about it. But they did well, and it's not as a result of government policy. I mean, if we check, it's not as a result of government policy. It is because maybe they maybe allocated more forex to them, but it's not really that. And then if you started your argument, your budget presentation, and you grounded it in that this sector is doing well, then invest in it. And so we didn't see that overwhelming investment. So I think that is something very interesting that I looked at.
One of the unfortunate things in this country is that politicians don't avail themselves to be scrutinized. And I raised that in the context that we here on the station invite almost everybody you can think about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because I want to talk to them or I want to take a picture with them or anything like that. It's because they need to come and account to the people, to the citizens, about why things are taking place. Not necessarily because you want to beat them down, but you want a greater understanding of what's going on. And there may be things behind the scenes that the average individual is not aware of that could explain some of what's going on. But that's like pulling out a tooth on your own to try to get some of them to come. There's something that I don't know if you all noticed it. I don't know if anybody else noticed it. We continue to say that we need to diversify the economy.
Mm-hmm.
We continue to say that this is an oil and gas-based economy. How do you justify $35 billion from the non-energy sector and $20 billion with the deficit or whatever else that come from the energy sector, and still tell me that this is an oil and gas based economy? Your responses?
Sadish, I will take that and say that it's an oil and gas based economy because oil and gas has been the traditional generator of revenue for us coming in, and mm-hmm. I think that is a critical question that now ties into the previous point about how do we move away from a deficit budget, because the reality is as long as we keep having deficit budgets, we are going to be in debt, and debt is something that young people are going to inherit and have to deal with going forward. So I think that's something I want to talk a bit on. How do we move away from a deficit budget? What are the goals that we are setting? I think there needs to be greater accountability and accessibility of information around the budget and around national goals and visions. So we have a budget. We have a vision, Vision 2030. What are the goals that we are working after? What are the objectives? What are the indicators that we have set towards those goals? And how is the budget allocation now allowing us to move to those indicators? And how do we report on that? And if we start creating, I mean, there are frameworks used for development. I mean, I'm in the development sector, we use something called a log frame. I'm not an economist, and I don't know about macroeconomics well, but I'm sure that there are tools that can present the information and the impact of the spend in line with the indicators and the goals and the objectives well, and that could be used as a starting base for us to understand what is happening in the country. That will also allow us to communicate the information better, because the reality of the matter is young people are not going to sit down for 4.5 hours to listen to the minister present a budget speech. And then the information that becomes accessible after, how many people can actually go into it and understand it well there. And the young people I am speaking about, because we want them engaged in the conversation. We want to hear the ideas that they are saying. When we look at moving away from a deficit budget with the reality of declining oil and gas revenues and diversification, it really has to come back. How are we supporting, how are we diversifying, and how are we enabling exports? How are we enabling our ability to earn foreign revenue to support what we can do? So when we think about diversification, a lot of allocations have been made towards very good things I saw in the budget. So apprenticeship programs, school, youth development, agriculture, a lot of good things have received allocations. The implementation of that, the skills that we are putting into there, I saw that they are investing in junior achievers. Mm-hmm. So that tells me that we want to see more business activity, we want to see more entrepreneurship in the future. So we're investing now in young people. It raises the question to me now, to what extent are we investing in that, in the development of skills to really facilitate these things? So are we investing in digital skills for these young people? Are we investing in things like corporate governance skills so that people can manage companies well? What are some of those things that we have to start thinking about? What do we need to be educating people for through our education system to meet those goals that we want, that we need to see, to move away from a deficit budget going forward? So diversification and the inclusion of young people in the conversations, because we can't keep having national discussions about what we want to see for the future and not have the young people who are going to inherit that future included. Of one part, to understand, how do we help young people understand more about how things actually work, so young people can make a little more informed decisions, but also hear their thoughts and their views and their ideas? Because they may have some ideas that might force us to really critically think about what we do. Mm-hmm. Some quick information, 70% of our economic activity is generated by the state. That has to change. Mm-hmm. The state invests the most in development. That has to change. And when we look at our major expenditure as a state, it's recurrent expenditure. So where's the development, where's the change happening in between? And I think articulating that a bit easier and a bit clearer, because from what was allocated, you can see that there is change, work on change happening. Just articulating that a bit clearer and easier for people to understand will now help us start to be able to critically understand and analyze.
We've spoken about some of what was presented already. Let's speak about some of what you all would like to see. Not necessarily in this budget. This budget's come and gone, but in budgets to come. When we speak about development, opportunities for young people, diversification, all of these various things, let's hear from you all. What are some of your views on where you started, Sergeant, started the discussion about where we should go and some of the things we should think about? Let's build on it. Tell us some more.
I think one of the things I was looking forward to hearing in this budget, and I heard nothing about it, would have been AI, right? One of the lessons that we would have learned from the pandemic is that technology is expanding very quickly, and well, AI is a result of that. And I'm graduating in November, by the way, and AI is being used by students and lecturers, and it is something that we should not demonize just so quickly yet. We have to find a way to incorporate it in many different areas in our in many sectors. And I know we have a Ministry of Digital Transformation. So I was a bit surprised not to hear about AI and the expansion of that. Now, I want to credit the Ministry of Trade, because I do know they have tried with the digital economy as it pertains to TTBiz link. But unfortunately, it's still not good enough. I believe, is it Zambia? They have been doing almost their online payments since 2016. And they are not even as developed as, they don't have the type of resources that we have in Trinidad and Tobago. But that would have been something that, as a 23-year-old, with its coming out of the tertiary education system, understanding that it is an asset to us, I think that is that we need to have a conversation surrounding AI a bit more. And of course, data-driven policy, before we could even dream about anything else. I think the National Statistical Institute, we've been hearing about that in 2016 budget, in 2019 budget, 21, 22. We heard about it this budget as well, you know. I remember I was on a panel discussion, I was moderating a discussion, and there's a minister, and I asked that minister particularly about this, and she could not give me a direct answer. She said, well, we need the opposition support. We need this, we need that. But we can utilize data. There's data still that we can utilize. I know the Ministry of Education, they utilized it to a certain extent. So you don't necessarily only need an institute, but we've been speaking about that for the past how many years. I'm expecting to surpass the conversation stage. I feel like we just, it's a talk shop.
So from my perspective, in terms of, no, I'm not an engineer, neither am I a transportation consultant, but one of my biggest bugbears was something that I think that we should look at in budget. I mean, we speak about it. You see the issue of traffic, and I know everyone says, whatever, every time I raise it on a panel, someone says, well, the even larger cities across the world have traffic, and I'm not denying that traffic isn't an issue, but I think the issue of some sort of mass, properly functioning mass transportation system will have a beneficial impact here in Trinidad and Tobago, even a properly working bus service, just as simple as a bus service, because a lot of our issues, when we look at productivity and family life, lack of that ability to have a proper functioning family life, stems from the fact that people sit 2 hours from San Fernando to Port of Spain in traffic on a daily basis, and they have to sit in traffic heading back down. And I come from Chagones every day, so I understand part of what I'm speaking about. And I travel. So I think that a properly working transportation system, public transportation system, will contribute a great deal to Trinidad and Tobago. And I've traveled to many places before, and I've utilized public transportation systems. And I mean, yes, people in those countries do complain about the fact that they may not function 100%, but they still do function better than what we have in Trinidad and Tobago. And for a small island in the Caribbean, and with the resource that we have had over the years, we fail in that area of traffic and public transportation system.
Yes, Sen.
So I hope to see in the near future greater investment being put towards civil society organizations and youth organizations, because I feel like citizen participation and active citizen participation will propel the development of Trinidad and Tobago, building on what my colleagues would have shared before. You have young people that has innovative solutions, and your civil society organizations are the ones on the ground, the foot soldiers who honestly understand what is going on. Yes, statistics may tell you that this community is facing this issue, but you see the actual lived experiences. I feel like statistics don't paint the lived experiences of many. And data is probably skewed in Trinidad and Tobago because we haven't, as you mentioned before, we haven't had a survey done recently. I've seen that the social sector investment program is speaking a lot about surveys and doing a household budget survey to understand the expenses. But you really need to understand the lived experiences of people. So I'm hoping that we could invest more in the civil society organizations so that they can push out more programs, because you have organizations just like the Heroes Foundation that is actively working towards developing youth, and you can't rely solely on government agencies to do this. You really need the civil society organizations. Number two, the implementation of a work from home policy. I work from home. I don't work for a local agency. I work for a Canadian Parliamentary Institute. And transitioning from public sector into work from home, I get way more done. I am way more happier as a citizen. And I know the rest of Trinidad Tobago will appreciate something like this. I'm originally from South Trinidad, and I would recall colleagues who wake up 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning to come to work. Can they actively fulfill their duties by the time they reach the Port of Spain? No. So we really need to implement a work from home policy to, one, make the public sector more effective, and two, reduce traffic. if you have less people coming in support of Spain, you solve that issue. Decentralize, you solve that issue. Mm-hmm. And COVID-19 was the perfect time to show that it was effective. Mm-hmm. Even when I was still working in the public sector, I had opportunities to work from home. I was able to plan a beach cleanup from home because I had COVID. So we really need to look towards implementing a work from home policy. Another thing that I am looking forward to in the future is to dealing with the root causes of crime. I feel like right about now we're dealing with the symptoms. Crime, it's a multifaceted issue. It has a lot to do with what is going on externally, corruption, etc. But at the root cause, the small man who is involved in crime, I feel like it's a social issue to deal with. And you'd hear social workers talking about there's not enough social workers. I think we need to invest a lot more in getting social workers on the ground to deal with these issues, because when you hear about the lived realities of persons, it's a messed up society we're dealing with. True. Mentally, some of the experiences of our young people and children, you really need social workers to work. And we also need to stop operating in a way where one ministry is doing one thing and the next ministry is doing something and they don't know what's going on. Need to work together to plan proper interventions to address the issues in this country.
The issue of crime is one that affects every single thing in this country, whether we like to accept it or not. Crime impacts on foreign investments. It has impacted severely on how businesses operate. It has impacted on the quality of life for citizens because people now live in self-imposed curfews behind bars. And it goes on. But for some strange reason, we've not been able to get a handle on crime, and crime has gotten progressively worse. And even though we are spending more money on crime, that obviously is not the solution. You spoke about social services. I have a pretty strong approach, strong view on crime, and people don't like when I tell them what it is I think we need to do. And my opinion is that we need to stamp out crime, and we need to send a message first and foremost. I understand the holistic and the long approach and mentoring, and I've had every discussion all I could think about on crime with everybody that you could think about, from criminal the criminologist. And quite frankly, as a citizen, I think, don't do the wrong thing because it's the wrong thing to do. And when you do the wrong thing, there must be severe consequences to send the message to others that you don't do the same thing. But we have pussyfooted around the issue for far too long. Mm-hmm. And now, the horse has bolted. And we are trying now to implement long-term measures to fix an immediate problem. Because every time we talk about crime, I hear about social workers, I hear about a vicious cycle, I hear about mentoring, I hear all of them nice, pretty things.
Sports.
But those are long-term measures that take a society from where it is to where it needs to be. We need some short-term measures to deal with the thing. What's your opinion?
I believe that we just simply are not doing anything about crime because people benefit from crime. And let's be real here. There are people in Trinidad and Tobago who benefit from crime. I'm not speaking about the gangsters or the ones who are controlling gangs, who go out, who send their men out to murder somebody or collect...
Who are you talking about? You say that's a vague statement.
That's what I'm getting at. So that's what I'm saying. It's not just those people who send out their men to shoot somebody or murder somebody's son or somebody's grandson. It is those people at the very top.
How do you know that?
Let's be real. The men on the ground, they are not getting.
I'm asking you a specific question.
Right, so I'm answering you. So I'm saying they are not able to just have money to just fund things through the port. And it's what we are dealing with here in Trinidad, because a lot of organized crime. How can you sit back normally or comfortably as a minister or even as a prime minister and tell me that our ports have no scanners for many years? How can you now tell me that? In this budget, we've now decided to allocate money to... And it's coming next year. Like, seriously, we've been talking about crime for so many years, as you mentioned, and people benefit from crime, and we are not being real and having real conversations.
I'm going to play devil's advocate, because I hear that a lot. And there may be truth to it. that there are well-organized crime climbs the ladder politically, socially, and every other thing that you can think about. But who are you accusing of being in cahoots with criminals? The present minister? And because you're saying that high-ranking official... No, but... you see, the question is one that needs to be answered, because I hear that all the time.
I understand.
Well, this one involving crime and that one involving crime. And you see, we in this country, we fast and loose with the mouth. But when you drill down into it, trying to get, well, on what are you basing this? You can't answer me.
Well, on the mere fact that a minister could sit and simply allow a country to not have ports.
Yeah, but that's even, a dangerous. Even, no, even, that's even a in, dangerous.
But even
link
national,
to make.
No, but even in national security, there are containers that come in on a daily basis and they just are not searched. When you have when up to last year, between let's say the start of last year and even up to now,
right.
There have been at least two or three, if I'm not incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Containers that were found at customs bonds with guns in it. Why are we not tracing back these things to the sources? There must have been somebody who would have sent this through. There must be somebody on the receiving end that has to collect it in Trinidad and Tobago.
You are expressing the sentiments of a wide cross-section of the country, because there are many people who feel the very same way and think the very same way. And it's a logical deduction to think, well, yeah, now, somebody benefiting from this thing being the way that it is. But who is the somebody?
I'm Satish, I want to jump in here on this one. In a different perspective, because when we talk about corruption, it's easy to talk about government corruption, because it's a big abstract entity and we can say all kind of things. But when we look at the reality of corruption and crime in our society, the whole society involved. Look at licensing office and licensings and licensing. How many people listening here have had to pass a little something to get your license? And there are a whole lot of other things that we can talk about there. But what I want to do is come back to this point of accountability and communication, and not just for the budget, but throughout the implementation of the resources that have been provided to do the work for the people. And I think that's an interesting conversation that we can have with the Minister of Finance to understand, well, so as you allocate these resources that these ministries and these state entities have asked for, how are they now being held accountable for how they manage your money? I'm sure there are things in place for that. I think it's a conversation to understand that and hear some different perspectives in there. Because when we look at things like revenue collection, the revenue authority is coming on board. Hopefully we can get some money from people who are avoiding their taxes right now from that. We need to look at NIS, because that is a big risk looming for young people in the future. So extending the employment age
to 65,
all well and good for the rationales put forward. My concern is, how many employers do we have in this country who are not paying an ELSA charge for their employees, and what can we put in place to address that? Because all of that is part of the crime problem. Because if I cannot pay my taxes and I could not contribute to something where I can get away from doing, from being held accountable for a crime that I do, how am I going to now ask the states to be accountable and to be honest with me if I am not doing that? And then I want to really challenge our politicians to create those spaces for critical and collaborative discussions. That's what Parliament is supposed to be, because we have an opposition in there who's supposed to represent the people to hold the government accountable, but we don't have collaborative discussions happening in our Parliament. And if it doesn't happen in our Parliament, now where else can we start having those conversations? Because the world is transitioning. The world is going through a transition. The world is still in chaos. We as a country, we are in the same position. So how are we creating space where we can explore the ideas, where we can talk about, I mean, one big idea I will toss out is, and I've been tossing it out for the last year and a half, is, do we need a Ministry of Public Utilities? Should tea and tech not be part of the energy value chain under Ministry of Energy? Should WASA not be part of Ministry of Work so they can manage and coordinate their maintenance so we're not digging up the road after we pave the road? And should TSTT not be part of some ministry with digital transformation and communication and those sorts of things? Where are we creating these spaces as we transition and try to manage challenges to look at where, what else can we be doing as a country? How do we now get the accountability coming into there through the implementation so that we can hold the police accountable, the licensing officers accountable, and all the other places where we know there is corruption happening accountable? And then how do we, coming back to Chris's point and your point on crime is two-pronged approach. You need your crime response and you need your crime prevention. To deal with crime response, we need to deal with the corruption. One, we need to deal with the speed at which the system itself operates to prosecute people and charge people and hold people accountable. But we really need to spend the time on the prevention. And if we look at it from an education perspective, that emphasis on psychosocial development, the mental health, the well-being of young people, the ability to engage with society, we're not doing a lot of that in the school anymore. And we're seeing that in the behaviors and the values coming from people. We're not spending time on the critical 21st century skills. People call it soft skills. Skills, but it's the skills that create problems in the workplace: communication, critical thinking, collaboration, those sorts of things that, you know, people complain about. You know, you're not getting young people who want to work and who can work well in a space. Where are we investing in the young people who we want to see come into the workplace going forward? The technology skills. What are the sort of technology skills that we are implementing? And I know there's been the Ministry of Digital Transformation actually has put up these centers across the country with the community centers to invest in technology skills. Those are the kinds of things that I think we need to hear more of and see more of integrated into the education system and what our education system is doing. A lot of money is being invested into youth development programs, into the apprenticeships, into those kinds of things. That's good. That's great. The agriculture homestead project, very critical. I want to see 10 years down the road our food import bill reduced significantly. But what are those other skills that we are now making sure that they are included in there? How do we understand what is in there? And how do we see that from an accountability perspective to make sure that digitization, all of those things are in part of how we are acting to change the current trajectory?
See, one of the problems with the trajectory is that the trajectory is determined by people who came from a different time. And whose perspective, and I want to describe them as dinosaurs, right? But I often say that one of the clearest examples of how we as a nation have not moved forward is tourism. Mm-hmm. Our tourism product is still badly packaged. Okay. We in the ministry, I was talking about the Minister of Tourism, we issued 7 invitations for him to come here and he has not accepted a single one. Our tourism product is still sand and sea and carnival. Whereas you have an entire movement across the globe where people are looking for different experiences. Yes. Culinary tourism is one of the biggest, fastest growing forms of tourism in the world. You have people who go to Bali and Vietnam and one trip Vietnam and all these people making a set of money off of them and they're carrying them in a rice field. One of the... I like these vlogs and I follow them. And one of the tours in Vietnam is to go in somebody's house and see what they do for breakfast. And you have people going and master these things. They want those experiences. They want to taste different things. And another one is ecotourism.
Yes.
We have here at home, do you all know that we have white bats in this country?
I wasn't aware of that.
We have in central Trinidad a cave with white bats. I don't know exactly where it is, but I know it's in central Trinidad. I was in Sangre Grande doing a live show and
that was brought up.
And I didn't know that. If we put that out on the international landscape, can you imagine? But the point that Mr. Arjun was making is that we need to move from where we are into a more futuristic approach, because that's where the world is going.
I want to say this, and I think each one of us could agree with this here. You mentioned the word dinosaur, right? Mm-hmm. We had a local government election recently. Usually, you see a low voter turnout for local government. You wouldn't see the voter turnout like a general. But this 30.34%, I believe, or 30.43%, was the lowest that we have seen in a decade. Which means that the country were not interested, despite the policies or plans or the old talk that was put forward. And I think it has a lot to do with, and it might be able to address many things that we discussed here, the way that we view politics as it is party before country, and it's about tribal politics. And I think once we're able to put our political pride away and see persons for competence rather than loyalty to party, or they serve this amount of time, or, well, that's not my party in charge of the THA, so I will just give all you $260 million. And then any budget, as the Minister of Finance, I might say something like, well, good luck with that. I think that kind of attitude and behavior is something that young persons, we're not buying into. And I say this, and I mean, yes, we have the sitting government being a part of the Red Party, but we put the notice onto all political parties that young persons want new politics and not old politics. And if you're interested in that, well, good luck at the polls.
Well, I've heard that before as well. Mm-hmm. In 2006 or 2007, with the creation of the Congress of the People, the Congress of the People said to this nation that their support was mainly young people. And we did see young people coming out to their rallies and all of that kind of thing. And then it fell to the wayside. The young people didn't, I think, buy into what the Congress of the People did at some point in time or the other. But so young people involved in politics, I hear it. But what would it take? Because we have a variety of parties that represent a variety of issues. Is it that what exists is not appealing to young people, does not cater to their needs or what they think is important?
How you engage us? I mean, in an election, you cannot come and think, you can't stereotype young persons and think we're interested in dancing and singing and gunman tune. I think that's disrespectful. I think we are more than that. We are a diverse community of persons, that is the youth group, and there are young persons who are interested in sports, tech, zest, everything. I think I'm a little bit of everything. But you don't engage us through that. And then when you start bad. You start bad already. So I think it's not particularly the messenger, you know. It's the crafting of the message. And if you think you're speaking to us, well, you're not speaking to us. And that's where the voter turnout is that way. Mm. And there's that disengagement from young voters. And that is for all political parties, eh? Not the sitting government alone.
Mm. It's interesting. You want to add something to
this? Yeah, sorry, Sean. Just adding into that, it really comes down to how are we engaging and how are we respecting young people in the conversations. The generations are different.
Mm-hmm.
The generations are diverse. We have to understand what are the goals, what are the vision, what motivates young people. Young people aren't going to get behind a political party because it's something that their families have done. Young people are concerned about the future that they are going to inherit. So how are we now having the conversations and bringing them into the conversations that we are having about these issues? And that's what we need to do. Politics is important in the country. Governance is important in the country. We need to be having the spaces and including people in the conversations and changing how the way things are done, because we are at a tipping point in our country.
Mm.
The decisions that we are making today are going to directly impact what happens tomorrow. And just coming back to the previous point about the spaces of collaboration, you know, one ministry that I think has been doing that collaboration with stakeholders well is Gender and Child Affairs, Office of the Prime Minister, mm-hmm. Gender and Child Affairs. I've been very impressed with my engagement with them and how open they are to feedback, including critical feedback. I mean, they take the licks. So there was the child abuse investigation, there was the task force that came from that, and then there was the budget allocation last year towards implementing the actions of the task force. Again, those things weren't communicated. We didn't hear a lot of those things happening, but that's the work that is happening. As a country, we have to implement a woman, peace and security framework for the country. And what Gender and Child Affairs did, they said, you know, they brought together the whole of civil society and all the different stakeholders and said, we're trying a different approach. We have to do this. We want all of you all included from the start. And I think that the work of that particular ministry is going unnoticed. And it's an example for the rest of the state and the rest of the government to look at and pattern. How do you take leadership of what you are responsible for? Create spaces to have the critical discussions, the hard discussions. Take the licks on the things that you're not doing better. Be open to hearing different perspectives. And then also now facilitate the spaces where you can bring different people together to help chart the way forward, because that is what we need.
This futuristic engaging approach that you're speaking of, that you're alluding to, do you all think we could get that from the present crop of political parties and politicians?
No. I am sorry, I'm really reaching the point where I believe it's time for young people to create their own party. It's plain and simple.
No, I have to disagree with you. I think there is always hope, right? Let us be very serious here. There are persons on both sides of the political divide. I mean, younger people, though, you see, practicing newer politics. And I think that both political organizations or institutions, they have contributed much to national development. They have contributed to a lot of negatives, but a lot of national development. And they are vehicles. But I wouldn't say no to both. I think they are persons. I think leadership is important. So maybe we might have to have a conversation about leadership. That might be a better conversation to have. But when you really look at the way the seats are aligned, the 41 seats, and you look at the general elections, and you have to, they have really, it's you're fighting a political animal that is from 1956, and then the UNC 1995, and then UNC dates back to being a part of NAR. And so there's a lot there, but I think what we can do is, I think, work with what we have. And there are persons, I mean, you look on both sides, there are persons like Penelope Beckles, there are persons like Rushton Parry, Anita Haynes, and you see the difference in the style of politics that they portray.
Yeah, that's always an interesting element of any discussion that we have when we speak about the governance of the country, as to whether or not what exists presents the opportunities that young people feel they need. Because unless the opportunity is presented, young people are quick to reject if they do not believe that this is what they need or they want or they feel is acceptable at this point in time. And the lack of engagement that you all are speaking of here is alarming, because political parties always boast that they are all inclusive and they have the voice of the young people and they cater to this one and that and the next. But from the various perspectives that you all have outlined to me already, it seems that they're getting it wrong. And they ain't just getting it wrong by a little bit, they're getting it wrong by a long shot as to what young people really want. And you're right, this local government election that we saw, the lowest turnout probably in our history, should have been a wake-up call to the political parties that the country is not necessarily satisfied with any of them. The PNM could not boast of any kind of major showing as the UNC. I mean, the results 7-7, you split down the middle, we get one district here and another district there, which is nonsensical in the greater scheme of things.
And additionally, when we heard them speak about the fortress of Arima or even the fortress of Princeton, well, how it comes so close? How did it come so close? So you're absolutely right. It should have been a wake-up call. And I also want to say that even though we know that when we compare local government voter turnout to general, it is significantly different, but it was way lower. The way that both parties campaigned, they campaigned as though it was a general election. And that is an important thing. And it didn't even pull that amount. We even saw potential alliances and those things. And it is the status quo remains the same, 7-7.
There's just one point I want to add, though. I think with the participation of young people and COVID, I'll be really, really quick. You can't just blame the government or the political parties. I personally believe that general society, those that are older, are not ready to actively include young people in positions of power. Because you had, in this local government election, young people put themselves forward. And you would hear on both sides that they would have interacted with the burgesses and people saying that you're too young, you're not ready, you don't know enough. So you need a transformation of society on a whole. You can't just blame the political parties. This is the views expressed by older generations. And they might say, we need more people involved, we need more young people. What are young people doing, young people? There's a disconnect between young people and the older generation. Plain out.
We do have joining us now our fifth guest. That's Kobe Nathan Sandy. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, Satish. Good morning, my colleagues in studio. And good morning to the country. You know, I was listening while I was coming up the road, and I think we have some really nice, you know, boastful discussions, and I want to go into that topic of youth engagement and youth inclusion. And whilst, of course, we have to hold to account our politicians, the older generation, the current leaders of society in both business, government, and civil society, we have to look at politics within the youth space. And I always say this whenever I get a chance to, because we have to balance the thing. In 1972 or 76, don't laugh at me, you know, I'm giving history here. We would have had a great youth movement that would have, of course, transformed how the country would have operated, the Black Power movement. And being a former Guild president, I would have, of course, the Guild would have been able to coalesce young people throughout the country to speak up against, at the time, of course, discrimination, as well as, of course, inequality within the banking system, within job, within employment, and so on and so forth. That type of coming together is what, of course, caused the powers that be at the time to pay attention to the issues in the country. What we have now, we have a lot of young people, many of us in different positions all over the place, wanting more positions, wanting to be called, and considered and looked at and to dress good and to come out of a nice car, and all of those things, quick, without, of course, coming together and understanding the real issues. We want to fight each other for a position. We want to fight each other down for, you know, doing what we have to do instead of coming together. And I think in order for us to, of course, demand the respect that we deserve, we must, of course, first, respect each other, respect our own work, respect our talents. We may have differences, of course, like, as every human being. But in order for us to really and truly signal to society that, hey, young people, we want to, of course, take ownership of our society, we have to, of course, take ownership of ourselves. You know, so I will say that, you know, when it comes to youth engagement and youth being respected in the political landscape, we must respect ourselves, respect each other, for us, of course, to get the respect from outside. And, of course, that is a simple thing, to consider when it comes to, of course, how young people are looked at and perceived, because it's not really good on how they... Of course, society has to work on how they deal with young people, but we have to, of course, be that change we want to see in the first instance in order for persons to really and truly give us that same respect that we need.
Well, unfortunately, we're coming close to the time when we need to drop the curtains on our interview, but we've covered a lot in the time that we were here, and the discussion started off focusing on the budget, but we've gone to much, much broader issues of a national nature. That coming together that you're speaking about was present in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. But we must admit as well that since 1970, we have allowed politicians to divide us so that same coming together will not be possible. And they've done a very good job of that. They've ensured that movement, that coming together, that camaraderie that saw those developments in 1970, it was picked apart. And now people have gone into their own various areas and see it as a survival mode, that I need to be by myself or associate with people I think who are on my side so that I can survive against the challenges presented by persons on the other side. Young people, and when I speak to young people, what is clearly evident is that young people don't buy into those divisions. When it comes to race, when it comes to culture and social and economic standing and so on, young people are quicker to dismiss those things because they don't see it as important. They don't see it as relevant. But we have systems that are built on those divisions. So that's why young people many times can't associate, can't engage themselves with what's going on, because it's a status quo that they don't subscribe to. But in a political system as ours, that is built on divisions, it's an uphill task to change this. Well, and with I don't have time for closing comments from you all because we have the ads to take us up to the top, and Tosca, she here already. So it's time for me to vacate the studio.
Even before you go, because I mean I was not in the fullness of sense with my colleagues, but I also want to say that we must acknowledge the contributions that government is making into young people. And June would have shared it, what is happening in the new Ministry of Youth Development. I'm a proud employee there, and I can say to you, Satish, is that, you know, the opportunities for young people to, of course, come out of their social standing and to, you know, to take advantage of society is there. One of the recent things that is coming out right now is that we are going to boost entrepreneurship, and Minister Cummings would have spoke about it, where, of course, we are going to give some hundreds of young people $20,000 to really stimulate their grant and not loan, to stimulate their business endeavor. And these are real opportunities that you can see with your eyes, you can feel with your hands, and you can feel it in the spirit.
Okay.
And I think that these are the things that are needed and to be discussed and to be lauded more than the negative.
I agree with you that there needs to be greater information, but even in what you just outlined, people feel discriminated against. And you may not accept or agree with their perspective, but if I open the phone lines now, mm-hmm. and I say, call us, tell us what you think about these initiatives, the first question they go ask is, well, how were these people selected? And why was there or was there? And it's not necessarily the truth, but it's the perspective that exists. Mm-hmm. I know everybody wants to weigh in on this one. Mm-hmm. Quickly, Mr. Arjun.
Accountability and communication.
Yeah, we spoke about that all morning long. This is where we're going to have to leave it because I do have a lot of commercials. We could continue this conversation another day. Probably we may need a part 2, 3, 4, a series, because it's a discussion in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yes.
The youth, they are the future. They are the ones who will inherit the earth. And if we mess up the thing too much for them, they have a real hard time
right. In
moving forward. I want to thank each and every one of you for being here this morning. It's been a spirited discussion. And it definitely requires a part 2. I'm sure Caitlin listened to this already. She must be done calling some more, yeah?
But where there is youth, there will always be energy, you know?
Yeah, definitely so.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.